Let's call the meeting to order. Let the record reflect the representatives Phillips, Smith, Snyder, Kelly, and Rudd are present. This morning, we'll take up House Bill Number 219, an act on permits and fees for the construction of onshore facilities associated with outer continental shelf natural resource extraction. This bill has a number of sponsors. Mr. Parr is the prime sponsor, and he has provided us with the packet of material that I hope you've all had a chance to look at. It looks like this. And Mr. Parr, we would be very happy to hear from you at this time.
Madam Chairman, members of the committee, House Bill 219 is a reintroduction of what came in last year as House Bill 564, and later on in a different version is House Bill 919. If you've had a chance to read the memo I sent over, I think you're familiar with the outlines of the problem. The energy shortage in the United States has resulted in a decision by Congress and the President to increase the exploitation of outer continental shelf oil and gas leases. The Supreme Court has held 2 years ago that anything beyond a 3-mile limit belongs to the federal government and not to the states. And so this means that the leasing is handled by the federal government. More important for us, it means that all of the revenues derived from this, royalties, severance taxes, or any other kind, also go to the federal government. Now, the state does not collect any of this revenue. The amount of revenue will probably be pretty significant. There has been action in Congress in an attempt to do something for the states affected, because the states, of course, are complaining quite bitterly about this. But all that has been done so far is that Congress has passed an act which will make $800 million in loans and $400 million in grants available. Unfortunately, the grants are available for planning purposes and certain other specific uses, and they are not grants for impact assistance. I think it's clear that there will be impact on the state of Alaska. The President's Office of Management and Budget estimated that the impact cost of governmental infrastructure alone at $683 million. I have seen a state estimate last year which was somewhere about $400 million. In any case, there is expected to be a large impact cost to the state. Those of us who have been along the pipeline realize that there are impact costs associated with any large-scale development. Only thing is there, the development took place on our own territory, and we had the legal authority to compensate for it by taxes. The $25 million the state put out for impact costs on the pipeline was compensated for. In this case, there will be no compensation, no significant compensation, unless we make it happen. I don't believe that the taxpayers of Alaska should bear the impact costs, so that people in the lower 48 can, as I said in my initial written presentation, run their air conditioners 24 hours a day, drive their cars at 70 miles an hour, and heat their houses with insufficient insulation and so forth. Now, if we do reach the conclusion that there will be impact on the state of Alaska due to the increased people working on this and increased activity, and we are not going to be compensated by the federal government, then the question arises as to how we achieve this compensation. The compensation should be furnished by those persons who are going to profit by the development. Those persons are the consumers in the lower 48. And the only way we can reach them is by putting, requiring the developers to pay for the impact and then to have them pass it on to those consumers. This is not a bill aimed at any punitive taxation of the oil companies. They obviously are not going to bear it. They're obviously going to pass it on to the consumers, although that will, may well be denied when you hear testimony from them. That's really what's going to happen in the long run. I might move briefly to the bill, Madam Chairman. I do have a number of sheets of material here which deal with various parts of this, but I think I won't go through all of the details of that. Essentially, the mechanism proposed is quite simple. The only handle we have to get this compensation are those facilities that are under the state's jurisdiction. This means the onshore facilities. It would normally mean those actually on land. However, the usual way in which this thing operates is to have pipelines coming from drilling platforms onto land. So it would also be a possibility of doing it through the pipelines running from the 3-mile limit into land. But that's the only handle the state has, whether it's under its jurisdiction. Essentially, the bill attempts to prescribe a mechanism for measuring the impact costs to the state and the municipalities, and then saying that this impact cost is the price of your building permit. You don't build your onshore facilities without having paid the impact cost. Now, last year when the bill first came in, it left it completely up to the Department of Community and Regional Affairs to determine the impact cost and to apportion it between the state and the municipalities concerned. There was objection, and perhaps rightly so, that this was rather arbitrary. It left too much power in the hands of community and regional affairs. The bill now has a formula in it for estimating the impact costs. Essentially, that formula says this, that we have estimates as to the number of people who will be brought in. We know what the cost of government is per capita, both state and municipal. And so we multiply the number of people expected to be brought in by this development times the per capita cost of government. That gives us our gross impact cost. But we obviously are going to get revenues from this as well. So we take our revenues, which would be income taxes we expect to derive from people working on these projects. We take the property taxes, which we expect to get from the facilities, and we take into account any revenue sharing which we expect to get from the federal government for OCS development. We subtract these expected revenues from our expected gross impact. What's left over is a net impact on the state. And that's the price of the building permit. I might add that the formula was basically furnished by the Department of Revenue, which had been trying to measure the impact costs in the past. I think, Madam Chairman, those are the essential features of the bill, and I'd open myself to questions.
Thank you very much. Are there questions for Mr. Fire?
To begin with, who authored the backup?
I did.
Okay.
Sorry, I should have my name on it.
That's okay. I was just not sure where it came from.
Did you have another question?
No, not really. It's all, the formula confuses me. But
it confused me too until Judith learned it, and then she managed to transmit it to me, so maybe we'll ask her to give us all a lesson. Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, if you bear in mind those 3 points, as I said, that you estimate the total impact is really based on your governmental costs, then you estimate the revenues you're going to receive as a result of the development. You subtract the revenues from the amount of impact you expect, whatever's left over is what's not compensated for, and that's what you want to claim.
How are the figures arrived at? You know, who guesses what the revenues are going to be and what the impact is going to be?
Well, the estimated population impact will, figures will come from the, the estimated increase in population will come from Community and Regional Affairs. They have been studying this subject now for, I think, at least 2 years. Mr. Waring may be able to tell you exactly how long, but quite a while. And we do, they do have the, they have experience, North Sea experience to go back on, as well as experience in the Gulf of Mexico and other places where this has gone on for a long time. It's fairly well known as to what facilities are necessary to do the development and exploration and production in the field. That this is fairly well known information. And so they would probably, I assume, be the ones to decide how many people we're going to get. Now the figure as to how much the cost of government per capita is, obviously in our last budgets, this is, and our budget, the state budget, and the budget to municipalities in the affected area, this is known information. So that part's not difficult. Now the Department of Revenue would be the one to estimate the expected revenues. And I don't believe there'd be any real difficulty on this part, because they would know from the information furnished by the Interregional Affairs as to roughly how many people will be working on the project and the estimated salary, the average salary per person, which will give them the income tax they could expect. And the property taxes will also be known, because if the, at present, if the facility is in a municipality, the property taxes, the mill rate is known. If it's outside a municipality, there is no property tax, except under the Pipeline Act, in which case it's also a known quantity. So there's no real, I don't think there's a real problem on that. The only thing that may be difficult to determine in revenues is what we're getting from the federal government. And as I said, really, in terms of grants, there's very little there except the planning grants. There's no, there's not, there aren't any specifically impact grants. I'm very general on this, but just these are the essential things.
Other questions, Mr. Parr? I have one. Charlie, you mentioned in the first part the gross impact cost covers a 20-year period. Do you intend to carry that 20-year period through the rest of the formula also, so
that's
that
a 20-year period.
All of the figures that you make are based on a 20-year projection?
That's right. Madam Chairman, I might mention that the 20-year period is arbitrary. It's arbitrary because there's no way to predict how long this will last. Now, some of the some people might buy the leases out there, and in a year or two or 3 years, they've determined that there's nothing out there for them. It's gone down the drain. You might have another field that is developed and produces for 30 years. There's just no way to predict just how long it's going to last. And I can't guarantee this 20-year period is the best one. The Department of Revenue, in its study from which I borrowed the formula, it used a 30-year period, but as I said, this is a matter that you would have to look at and say, well, which period do we want to use? It's, 20 years is arbitrary. I haven't found any reasons so far which say that you should choose a different one, but there may be some.
Other questions, Mr. Pratt? Thank you very much, Charlie. I hope you can stay for the rest of the period in case anything comes up. Thank you. Mr. Waring, we'd like to hear from you, I think. Could you identify yourself for the...
Yes, I'm
both of you.
Kevin Waring, Director of Community Planning in the Department of Community and Regional Affairs. And with me also to prevent some of the background information on this matter of revenues for local government and each of them. Is Niall Trimble, who is an economist on our staff. I thought to spend some time this morning, rather than dealing in at great length with the bill, just to fill in some of the context of issues and problems that the bill is meant to address, and at least perhaps give the committee members a little bit more feel for why this might be a matter of interest at this time. We had hearings last year, I recall, on essentially a very similar bill, previous to any lease sales up here, and I guess the theme of the hearing at that point was whether or not anything was going to happen in any of the communities in the vicinity of the lease sales. I think that has been answered somewhat authoritatively by some of the communities in the vicinity of the lease sale over the time since last May, when the first sale on the Gulf of Alaska was had. But I think that lease schedule, the federal offshore lease schedule, is probably the best beginning point. This is the Federal Department of Interior's schedule for offshore lease sales for Alaska, their schedule of what their intents are, at least for the foreseeable future, for leasing in the offshore provinces of the state. The initial lease schedule was announced back in October 74, and that was the time at which the state and not only our state government, because this was a national program for accelerated lease of the Outer Continental Shelf, other states too began to lean back and take some appraisal of it. At that point, there were proposed for the state approximately 9 offshore lease sales, much as we had in the Gulf of Alaska, for Alaska in a 4-year period. We're now 2 years later and have observed some slippage in that sale. And there has been one sale, of course, in the Gulf of Alaska last May. There was another proposed for Lower Cook Inlet to occur, in fact, this immediate week past. The new secretary canceled that for a 3-month reassessment period while he himself decided to take measure of this program and decided where he wanted to go. There's one scheduled for Kodiak in November this year. And then beyond that, another 6 or 7 scheduled. Interior is now reevaluating this lease schedule with, it seems, a serious possibility that some of the original areas might be deleted indefinitely, areas like Bristol Bay where there are serious fisheries conflicts, or the Chukchi Sea up in the northwest off Kotzebue-Kivalina area where there are some pretty severe technological problems they're not confident they can handle with. But basically what we see laid out before us is a succession in a fairly brief period of time of major sales of federal interest in the offshore oil and gas. We've got in the state approximately half of the physical Outer Continental Shelf, and depending on whose estimates you care to accept, and they're pretty hypothetical really given the amount of geologic knowledge available, perhaps a third, perhaps a little bit more of the remaining offshore reserves in the country. Offshore oil isn't really anything new, at least in the Gulf of Alaska, Gulf of Mexico, pardon me, and in off California. There's already been substantial offshore development and in other areas of the world. The question crops up, why is it gotten to be a particular matter of concern for our state and also, as I say, other states that have reacted? And it comes out of, in part at least, I think, some of the very tax features that pertain to offshore oil development that Representative Carr was speaking of. Simply put, most of the facilities, most of the productive activity occurs by definition outside the 3-mile limit of the state's jurisdiction. The platforms, the rigs, the equipment, for the most part, is located beyond our taxing or police jurisdiction, whether it comes to environmental regulation, because we might be concerned, say, about spills or the need to raise revenues to take care of what happens at the other end of the operation, that is onshore. The fact is that the offshore facilities are and the operations there are beyond the reach of the state. So we find, depending from case to case, there's a real possibility of a serious imbalance between the tax base available to raise revenues, particularly for local governments, and the burdens that are put on them, the demands for port facilities, airport services, water supply and sewage. Right now, that's already a big problem. The need for water for use on the drill rigs is severely taxing sewage's ability to provide water, and a whole string of other things, providing residences, residential expansion, schools, or things of that sort. I think Representative Carr mentioned one estimate that had been done by the Federal Office of Management and Budget when federal legislation was being prepared to provide some sort of compensation to the states, and their estimate for Alaska, and this was by a federal agency with all the reason in the world to be conservative, is that due to the offshore program between 1976 and 1985, Alaska's population would grow somewhere in the neighborhood of $93,000 people, pardon me, and the public cost at state and local level would be something in the area of $680 million. They didn't come along with a revenue estimate to show what the difference would be as Representative Parr has in this bill, but if there's any validity at all to these, we can see that in the next decade and stringing out beyond then, there's a pretty substantial growth effect going to occur on this within the state. Which brings us to another nettlesome problem, and that is projecting what kind of workforce growth, what kind of population growth is it plausible to expect. I've got, for your information, some handouts, projections we ourselves have developed in department that I'd pass out. These are part of our ongoing work, and I pass them out more as a matter of illustrating what you can tell and what you can't tell when it comes to projecting what kind of workforce and population growth you might be, you might expect. We've got, if you look at just the top page, you can see that we're talking about the northern Gulf of Alaska. This is roughly the area in which the sale has already occurred, and in this case, employment. And we've got five separate cases because at the start, you don't really know what course lies ahead. And here we've laid out possibilities ranging from these five columns here. No find, two moderate find alternatives, and then a high find and a bonanza. It might be that in after a year or two of exploratory work, it proves that it's a dry, or at least there are no producible reserves, and shut down shop and go home, and there's very little effect. And that's a genuine possibility, at least it's happened in other areas. At the other extreme, we've hypothesized, I forget precisely how many billion barrels that represents now.
The top 5 billion.
5 billion barrels, roughly half of what's been found at least is proven reserves now at Prudhoe Bay. And while it's on the high side, it's not beyond probability at all. We laid out that alternative, and then alternatives in between, just to get some feeling of how, as you move along from the successive stages of exploration, during which period you begin to determine whether and where you've got any producible reserves, and then into decisions about what kind of technology you'll use, pipelines, offshore production, what related facilities you need in the way of oil terminals or LNG plants, and all of this is pretty hypothetical at the early stages. But as information becomes available and further decisions are made, it becomes more and more clear. While it's difficult to lay out the answer at the start, it isn't difficult to say if these facts prove to be the case or if these are the reserves proven, then you can expect effort and workforce growth and population growth on this scale. The remaining pages of this, you can see in page two, we've got a graph that just illustrates graphically a low of less than 1,000 during the exploratory stage and in new employment, tapering off to practically nothing by 1980-81, in the case that there's nothing producible. And so if you're sitting down in Yakutat trying to decide, or Seward or Cordova, what should we do, you've got to keep in mind the possibility that that may be the event that you'll be facing in a few years, literally no population growth at all, no residual. But you've also got to keep in mind the bonanza alternative, and that's the high graph where we peak out at something close to 14,000 in employment in a very short period of time, here 8 or 9 years after the initial lease sale, and again tapering off after the field is brought into production. But both of those are legitimate possibilities, that variation is one of the very things that aggravates the planning problems of the state and of local governments in projecting ahead the needs and facilities and services that are needed. But as I say, as we progress and move ahead, 2 years from now we will know very much better whether we've got a bonanza situation on our hands or a no-find situation on our hands. And so I don't think it's a major problem to deal with this uncertainty, knowing that you're dealing with hypotheticals that become clearer and clearer as you progress. I'd like, if it would be beneficial, perhaps to allow Niall Trimble here, who has got a great deal of experience with offshore oil development of the sort that is going to occur in Alaska, to just kind of run through what happens over the couple of periods of years after a lease sale. I think it might help give some more graphic feel of what is happening in the offshore operations, and particularly what is coming home to roost in the onshore communities who are going to be called on to, as I say, to host from the shore side most of what does go on in the offshore areas.
Thank you, Kenneth. Let me just say that most of the work that we've done on developments in the Gulf of Alaska have been drawing on the experience in the North Sea, because the conditions that we find here in Alaska are very, very similar to there, and this is the industry is thinking the same way. So the technology that you find in the North Sea will probably be transported fairly similar fashion in the Gulf of Alaska. And I spent 3 or 4 years at the University of Aberdeen studying North Sea oil, and it's this experience that we're drawing on in doing the work here. Now, when you get the development of an oil province, you can divide this up into about three stages. First of all, we have exploration. Secondly, development, and finally, production. Now, the first stage, exploration stage, consists first of all of the leasing process, where the state, or in this case the federal government, offers for sale the offshore leases, which are then bid for by the companies on a competitive bid basis, and they all put in sealed bids. And whoever puts the highest bid in gets the block. Sometimes they are withdrawn if the federal government feels the high bid wasn't high enough, and is below their own valuation of the block. Some companies bid up to about $60 million for individual blocks in the Gulf of Alaska, so quite a large amount of money is involved. The total take in the sale held last March is about $500 million. Within about probably 6 to 9 months of a lease sale taking place, you'll get rigs moving on to the area to drill wells. The exploration phase can last for anything up to about 6-7 years or thereabouts. Once you have rigs drilling, you would probably have discoveries, if there are going to be any discoveries at all, within the first year or the first 2 years. We've postulated that there could be perhaps 7 or 8 rigs working in the Gulf of Alaska if things go reasonably well. If, on the other hand, things go badly, they explore for a couple of years, nothing is found, then it may well be that there'll never be any more, 4 or 5, and after 3 years, they feel they've evaluated the area, they've found nothing worth developing, and it'll just fizzle out by about, say, 1979 or 1980. That's the exploration phase. Now, if they find oil during this phase, if the rigs make a discovery, then you move into an appraisal drilling phase. The companies need to drill not only just one hole to discover the oil, they also have to find out how much there is down there and what the characteristics of the field are. And they need to know this for two reasons. First of all, they've got to work out, is it going to be financially viable to produce the field? Is there going to be sufficient production to justify the immense cost of production in this area? And my own estimates are that to put a platform on a field in the Gulf of Alaska would probably cost somewhere between $500 and $700 million. So we're talking about a lot of money. And obviously they have to be pretty certain that they're going to get that back and something able to provide for profits. So they have to know whether it's financially viable. They also have to know a lot about the characteristics of the field itself, so they can know how to produce it. They have to know, for example, the best site to locate the platform on. Because depending on whereabouts in the field you put the platform, the amount of oil that's recoverable will vary. If you put it in the middle, then you can drill wells out to the sides and cover maybe a 2 or 3 mile radius from a central point. But the thickness of the oil sands varies throughout the field, and also to try and find the best part in order to get the optimum recovery of oil. So the companies have to do an extensive appraisal program, and this will probably take them maybe, once they've made the initial discovery, perhaps a year, perhaps 18 months. Now, having done that, you then leave the exploration stage and you move on to the development stage. If the companies decide that it is worthwhile, then they have to do detailed engineering work, engineering studies, to determine how the field can be produced, where the pipelines are going to be laid, what the design for the platform should be, what sort of equipment it's going to hold, what the capacity should be, and that sort of thing. Whereabouts land facilities should be located, if there are going to be facilities on land at all. And so between the discovery of a field and the time when you actually install a platform, we'd expect roughly 5 years to elapse. It's quite a long time. This is quite a lot longer than the time we saw in, say, the Upper Cook Inlet or in the Gulf of Mexico. But the investment involved here is very much greater, and the problems are very much greater. Conditions in the Gulf of Alaska are very bad. The water is very deep. The companies have never developed anything like this in the United States before, although the North Sea is similar. And we think they're going to take at least 4 to 5 years before they actually put platforms on. In the development stage, we see a number of things going on. First of all, you've got to install platforms on the field. These take about 2 years to build. We think it's unlikely that they would be built in Alaska because there are no facilities up here. There are better areas in, say, California or the Seattle area for building of platforms. So that won't impact very greatly on Alaska. They also have to provide some sort of transportation facility from the field itself to some sort of land terminal. Now, there are two methods that you can use to provide transportation. You can either lay a pipeline from the platform to a marine terminal, which will be on land somewhere, which will be basically a storage and a dock facility. But it will come in through the pipeline, it will be stored, there will be some treatment of it, although not very much. And it will then be sent out in tankers to its destination. The other possibility is that all the transportation will be done offshore, and the impact on the shore will be minimal. What you have is a thing known as a single buoy mooring, which is a large buoy moored about maybe a mile, maybe 2 miles from the platform. You have an undersea pipeline going from the platform to that buoy. Tankers will come in, tie up to the buoy, and they'll be loaded with oil from the field. And they'll then take direct to refineries in California or wherever, or Japan or wherever it's going to go to. Now, at this stage, obviously, you don't require land terminals. You don't require storage or anything like that. So at this stage, it's not possible to say which type of facility the companies would go to. If you'd like to look at the material we presented to you, we have the second and third scenarios. We have a moderate find with a pipeline and a moderate find with an SBM. And you'll see that the impact of the two is quite different. If you look at the, say, about 1981-82, you'll see that there's only about, with an SBM, there's only about 900, 1,000 jobs created. But if you have land facilities built, then you have 2,000 to 3,000 jobs created. This is mainly in the construction of an oil terminal, which is But if you see, there's two separate columns, on and off. Onshore, on means the employment onshore. Off means the employment offshore. That's on the platforms, on the rigs, and that sort of thing. Onshore means the people working on the construction of terminals, on the operation of those terminals once they're complete, and in service spaces administration and that sort of thing. So you see, there's quite a significant difference in impact between the two types of scenario. Other facilities which will be required onshore include, most important of these are supply bases. And these are the base from which the oil companies will send out material to the rigs and to the platforms. There'll be both storage and a dock facility. And these will be required during the exploration phase and during the development phase as well. Other possibilities that we might have include LNG plants. The USGS estimates for the northern Gulf of Alaska show that there could be quite a lot of gas up there. If this proves to be the case, then what you'd probably have to do is have a separate pipeline for the gas running into an oil, into the terminal, which could be the same as the oil terminal, it could be a separate area. You'll then have to have an LNG plant to liquefy the gas, and it'll be sent in LNG carriers to the lower 48 somewhere. It's not possible to do this sort of work offshore, it has to be done onshore. So if there's any LNG developments, that will be wholly onshore. You do need a fairly large volume of gas before you can do this sort of thing, whereas much smaller quantities of oil could be developed separately offshore, with offshore loading. But you need fairly big quantities of gas, and it would have to go onshore at some point for liquefaction. Once you move out of that phase, and let me just give a little bit more about the timescales involved. During the 5 years from the initial discovery of the field to the implementation, the delivery of the platform and its installation offshore, within 2 to 3 years of the discovery, if the company decided to go by the onshore route, what it would do was start construction of an oil terminal, and that would take about 3, maybe 4 years, and that would be ready for production at about the same time as the platform was ready to start producing. If you install a platform offshore, installation will take around about a year, give or take a few months, and then after that you move into the drilling phase, which will take maybe 5 to 6 years, and then the phase after that, when you finish the drilling, is the production phase, when all the infrastructure is in place and you're just producing. How much time do we have left?
We'll break about 5 minutes to 10.
Perhaps I could just finish there, and if somebody would like to ask questions.
Add one more thing to put it in perspective as far as what's the magnitude of the financial or fiscal problem, rather, that this bill and local governments in this state are coping with. If we take this as one instance, and not the bonanza, but the moderate find estimates run to employment in the neighborhood of 2,000, 2,500, and continuing employment for the long term of close to 2,000, and associated with it a total population growth somewhere between $4,000 or $5,000, $6,000, and ask ourselves, well, if we support those citizens in the same style to which I'm accustomed, and that's somewhere joint federal, state rather, and local expenditure of $2,000 per capita, we're talking from this one sale alone, public costs that run around $10 or $12 million a year. And as I say, this is the first of a series of a 9 or 10 lease sales scheduled over a fairly brief period of time, so there'll be that many times over, depending on how big and intensive development is in these other areas, that much larger a net problem to deal with. It's the fiscal impact is going to be quite substantial, and I think increasingly over the years there'll be some felt need on the part of local governments for some type of approach, whether it's this legislation or something comparable, to give them a better security protection on gaining revenue for their own fiscal needs. But I think we said enough, and I'd rather give some time for questions and things for the committee members to pursue.
Other questions of Mr. Waring or Mr. Trimble? I think you've given us a lot to think about. Yes, certainly, Mr. Trimble.
Mr. Trimble, just spare the time, just a minute. He said the drilling platform will probably not be constructed in Alaska. I wonder if he might just take a couple minutes to discuss what would happen if they went to the concrete. I've gotten the right name for those, which I understand would not be constructed very close to the site if they should go that route.
Let Niall answer that. He's talked a lot with the engineering people for the companies who are working out in the Gulf, and we've tried to get an appraisal of it because it's a pretty critical question.
Yeah. There are basically two choices for the type of platform you can put out there. Either a steel structure, which is a sort of lattice work of steel with a deck and equipment placed on top, or either the base being made out of concrete. Now, the implications of both of those are quite different. The steel platforms are relatively easy, relatively cheap to transport, and there are plenty of facilities elsewhere on the West Coast where they can, almost certainly would be built. So I think if it's steel platforms, then we can rule out any impact on the construction for Alaska. Now, concrete platforms is different. They require very sheltered deep water for the construction. They require maybe 500-600 feet of water in shelter and some flat land nearby. Now, these sort of facilities are pretty rare. And one of the areas which has them in abundance is Alaska. I'm just looking through some of the maps of the coastal areas. We can identify maybe 5 or 6 sites in the southeast, and several others around the south central area, one in Seward, for example. And these are the areas where concrete platforms could be built. Now, it then comes down to your assessment of what sort will be used in the Gulf. And at the moment, the companies are leaning very much towards steel. There are problems with concrete platforms. First of all, you can't use them in areas where the seabed is too soft, because these things weigh an incredible amount. They weigh about the sort of water depths we're talking about in the Gulf of Alaska, 300,000, 350,000 tons. They weigh the same as the Empire State Building. This is an analogy to you. So obviously the load-bearing capacity of the seabed's got to be very, very good. Now, this is a problem in the Gulf of Alaska. We have earthquakes. It's a very strongly earthquake-prone region. If the seabed starts to fluidize, if you have an earthquake, then the thing may just sink under its own weight. So a concrete platform could be very dangerous under those circumstances. There may also be problems when the seabed is actually very, very hard. because a concrete platform, unlike steel, does not absorb the force of an earthquake. It's rigid, it's not flexible. So it would get a very severe shaking, which might damage the welds, might damage the equipment on it. So when the ground is very hard, it may also be impossible to have a concrete platform. So the number of sites left on which you could install concrete platforms is fairly small. I've had estimates from some of the companies, it's only maybe 10 or 20% of the sites in the Gulf. Now, they haven't done detailed analysis as yet, and it would depend on the individual sites chosen. So there is a possibility, although probably only a small one, that concrete platforms might be used in the Gulf. Now, Alaska is one possibility where they might be built. There are also possibilities in the Seattle and Washington areas, Seattle and Vancouver areas. But at this stage, it's really a bit too early in the game to know whether they would be used and where they would be built. But it's certainly still a possibility they might be built in Alaska.
One final question is, would you maybe just tell the committee briefly, if they should decide to build one concrete platform or something like that, what is involved in terms of people and time?
The building of a concrete platform is split up into two phases. The building of the base, which is done in a dock on shore, which is then flooded. You float the base out and continue work. Offshore, you have towers rising up the base. The base is probably about 100 feet high. Then you have towers going up however high you need to get the thing above the waterline. The Gulf of Alaska, probably another 400 feet. And as you build these towers, you gradually sink the platform so that you're never working at height. Building of the base would probably take you about a year. Building of the towers and putting on the deck and that sort of thing will probably take about another year. The labour force involved would probably be somewhere between 1,000 and 1,500 men. Very roughly, that's what it is in Norway and Scotland. So it's a fairly substantial employer. We have assumed, incidentally, in these figures that there will be no platform building in Alaska. So any platform building will be in addition to those figures.
Thank you very much. Are there other questions? Thank you very much. I hope you'll be able to be with us as we continue deliberations next week on the bill.
Okay. There are a couple of things that I'd like to make available. I think you may have some of them. This is a summary of a study the department had done a short while ago by the Institute for Social and Economic Research, more or less looking at the question of fiscal management of these growth impact situations. That is, particularly the question of how might the state arrange transfers of revenues to local government, much like we did under the Pipeline Impact Program, and much as we do under a whole repertoire of other programs, the Foundation Program, revenue sharing, categorical grants. But the point of the study, and there are two other volumes that go with it, which I'll make available to you and to anyone else who might care for a copy, is to put this particular problem of how do we handle these rapid growth situations in a broader context so that we don't lose sight of the larger fiscal picture. The second study is at draft stage now, and we've sent it around for review and comments by local governments and industry. It's just pretty straightforward assessment of types of energy planning legislation other states have adopted. In fact, the majority of other states have adopted legislation of one variety or another dealing with the fiscal problems, the planning problems of these big facilities, whether they're huge power plants down in the southwest like at Four Corners, or hydropower projects or things of that sort. A lot of states have found the need to adopt some special legislation, just recognizing the fact that they tend to be huge facilities employing thousands and not your ordinary run-of-the-mill type development decision. As I say, this is just a straight laying out of different ideas and concepts other states have followed. A third thing that I didn't bring with me today but will provide is a whole set of background that goes with this, rather than dump it all on you today, but there's another 25 or 30 pages of text that elaborate on what you can tell for sure and what you can't tell for sure in these figures and just how we did derive them. But I'll provide all of these to you and provide multiple copies.
Do you have extra copies?
Yes, we do, of all of these.
Why don't each of you who wants any of those speak to Dorothy, and then she'll gather the total number we want and call you if that's okay.
Sure,
Kevin.
Sure.
Right. Thank you very much.
Okay.
Thank you so much for being
here. I'll be available if you need.
Okay, Grant, we'll be calling then. I'm sure we'll be calling then you again. Mr. Erickson, did you have some light to shed on this bill or this question for us today? We'd love to hear from you if you have any background you could give us.
All right. I'd be glad to answer any questions and briefly discuss the bill.
Thank you.
Is had the opportunity to discuss it.
Could you identify yourself for the recorder, please?
My name is Greg Erickson,
Director of Research for the Legislature. I had an opportunity to discuss the legislation after your assistant called, Madam Chairman, with the sponsor, and we went over it in some detail. I think we have, or at least I have, identified for my own purposes a number of problem areas. But before I get into those, I think I'd like to emphasize that I think if the committee and the legislature decides that the statement of findings, legislative findings, and the declaration of purpose contained on the first page of the legislation represents your views, that it is possible to implement those. I expect that it is possible to implement those in a workable way. There are, I would hasten to add, a great many difficulties, practical difficulties involved in doing so, and Representative Parr, in discussing this with me, identified some of them himself, I think, but to briefly run through them, I think, first of all, as Mr. Waring Mr. Trimble have identified, there's a great problem in estimating the level of impact. And the purpose of the legislation, obviously, is to ensure that the costs incurred by the community are transferred to the entities responsible for them. Since these are future costs, it's an estimation problem. In dealing with this, one has to trade off the problems of being arbitrary and possibly in running afoul of the Interstate Commerce Clause, if there is a problem there, with the problem of estimating the costs and developing ease of administration. So I think there's a trade-off involved there. If, as is the case in the bill at the present time, one is concerned about collecting this in a lump sum early in the game, then you may want to think about the need for an adjustment mechanism. One of the large uncertainties, which Representative Parr has indicated, is the level at which the federal government will, under present legislation or in future legislation, offset some of these costs through revenue sharing or other arrangements. There is a bill presently in the Congress which is given very good chance of passage and is expected to be in the President's desk by the end of the summer, dealing with this very fact, and it undoubtedly will undergo a great deal of change between the form it's in right now, it's S-9, and the form it's in when it gets to the President's desk, if indeed it does. But I think those problems can be solved. I don't have the solutions for you today, and I don't pretend to. There are some more difficult problems, though, and I call your attention to those, and that is, one is what I would call the allocation problem. The people who are responsible, or the entities who are responsible for imposing this extra cost on the community, are difficult to identify early in the game, or in a way that, and difficult to identify and allocate to them in proportion to the costs that they incur, the total cost. So once you solve the problem of deciding what the total impact is, the question is who pays it. Under the terms of the bill, as it stands right now, this question isn't addressed in any detail. It indicates that facilities onshore would pay a permit fee that would be presumably proportionate perhaps to the valuation of the facility or to some other measure of the economic impact. There are a number of ownership arrangements which may be used to possibly escape some of these the terms which might be used to escape payment of the fees under the way the bill is written right now. For example, I believe that the bill states that permits are required of a person engaged in exploration, development, production, etc., under terms of a lease from the United States, before that person constructs, leases, or in other manner provides for shore facilities. Well,
often facilities are constructed by third parties and then financed through, let's say, wharfage charges as material moves across a dock. That might be a type of ownership arrangement which might become much more attractive if, in fact, by doing so, they escape the permit requirement under this bill or under a bill like this. The allocation problem, which is, I guess, who should pay, is related to but separate from the incidence problem, which is how to make them pay. And I think that's also a very difficult problem. Clearly, the tax base that is most immediately reflected, immediately related to the incidence, is beyond the taxing jurisdiction, although I should add that the Department of Revenue believes that through their franchise tax, which they have been saying they will introduce sometime soon, would be subject to certain types of taxation. I think that indicates some of the practical problems, and I'm sure there's others that I haven't indicated, and I'm sure the oil companies will raise in great detail, so I won't go into any more on that. But I would again state that I don't think one should accept these problems as being a reason to throw up your hands and say can't be done, because I don't think that. I think if it's an important problem, if you agree with the findings, it's probably worth attacking them and at least seeing if it can be done. I suspect that one could make a good shot at it.
Thank you very much. Are there questions, Mr. Erickson? I guess I do have one, Craig. Mm-hmm. Have you had the time to think about how to address some of these problems that you raised? In other words, suggest possible amendments to the bill or anything mm-hmm. of that nature? Or have you not had the time yet to do that?
I just had time to think very briefly.
Think up the problems if you haven't thought of the solutions yet. Well, think harder. Work out how you to come up with some solutions.
All right. Well, I think Representative Parr and I have had some discussions and may have some more. Maybe
fine. That's fine. Thanks very much. Is there anyone else who would like to be heard on this bill? We just have a few more minutes. We'd be glad to hear from anyone else who would like to be heard.
I think your clock is slow.
Is it?
9:56.
Okay, yeah, I guess we'd better adjourn then. We'll take this bill up again next week. Mr. Parr's going to be out of town this week, so I told him we would hold it over till next week. But meanwhile, we have lots to think about and lots to study. There is an explanation of the formula in the memo that is in your packet from Judith to me. And if you still don't understand it after you've read that, I suggest you talk to her, because she does understand it.
We have to